In preparing for this moment of reflection on our membership in this church and our stewardship journey with you, my thoughts returned again and again to this little song we often sing together. From you I receive, to you I give, together we share, and from this we live. I feel that as a Unitarian Universalist, and for all of us as members of this church, we are all joined in a circle of giving and receiving. This is an ongoing circle and evolving. It really has no beginning and no end. Its two elements feed each other. Receiving releases giving. Giving, in turn, enables receiving. From you I receive. The you here is Foothills, but what do we receive from it? Foothills has been our spiritual home for more than 20 years. In the formal Sunday services and in meditations such as Vespers, we have received personal inspiration, guidance, challenge, and the illumination of pathways toward helping the wider world. The arms of countless fellow congregants have been opened to us, sharing glimpses of their lives, offering warm friendship and the precious gift of love. This endless procession of faces has been a source of profound joy. To you I give. Our covenant with the church has opened pathways to give back that are natural for us, arising from our own interests and special experiences. Anne's giving has been in the process of reaching out to new members, making them feel welcomed and guided into easy future communication with the church. For me, it has been in taking an active part in the unique musical gift the adult choir brings to the Sunday services. Beyond this financial side, the practical necessity of stewardship still exists. Our pledge to this church is not an obligation. It is the natural outcome of having found our own place in the circle, our own essential membership in its ongoing arc. Together we share. The process of giving and receiving demands commitment, and its rewards are shared by all of us in our mutual covenant with the church. As the years have passed, Anne and I have found these rewards have become ever more deeply layered. Our giving has also increased in a proportional way. Sometimes it even hurts a little. But these moments have also kept us aware of how important this church is to us and of the practical reality of its ever-changing needs.
As we come together, we light the chalice, asking you to share the vision that our mutual commitment will continue to be generous. We encourage you, be you member or friend, to joyfully offer your time and energy to our congregation and make a financial pledge to this church. From this we live.
I am the Reverend Audette Fulbright. I'm coming to you from your sister congregation in Cheyenne, and I asked to introduce this reading this morning. We're calling it The Other Half, but that's not the actual title of this article. The actual title is not appropriate for church, so let's just call it The Other Half this morning. It is by David Wong. And I think as you listen to it, you'll definitely understand why we're sharing it in this service. But it's a very long reading, and I want you to be thinking of it more as a homily on its own and a necessary piece for our service today. And so please enjoy the other half.
There's this universal shorthand that epic adventure movies use to tell the good guys from the bad. The good guys are simple folk from the countryside, while the bad guys are decadent jerks who live in the city and wear stupid clothes. In Star Wars, Luke is a farm boy, while the bad guys live in a shiny space station. In Braveheart, the main character is a simple farmer, and the dastardly prince lives in a luxurious castle and wears fancy, foppish clothes. The theme expresses itself in several ways: primitive versus advanced, tough versus delicate, masculine versus feminine, poor versus rich, decadent, traditional versus weird. All of this is code for rural versus urban. Now, that tense divide between the two doesn't exist because of these movies, obviously. These movies use it as a shorthand because the divide already existed. We country folk are programmed to hate the prissy elites. It's not about red states and blue states. It's about the country versus the city. You see, the U.S. is actually blue islands in an ocean of red. The cities are less than 4% of the landmass, but 62% of the population, and easily 99% of popular culture. Our movies, shows, songs, and news all radiate out from those blue islands. See, I'm from a blue state, Illinois, but the state isn't blue. Chicago is blue. And I am from a tiny town in one of the blood-red areas. As a kid, visiting Chicago was like, well, Katniss from the Hunger Games visiting the Capitol. Their ways are strange. And the whole world revolves around them. Every TV show is about LA or New York, maybe with some Chicago or Baltimore thrown in. When they did make a show about us, we were jokes, either wide-eyed, naive fluffballs, think Parks and Recreation and before that Newhart, or filthy, murderous mutants, True Detective, and before that Deliverance. You could feel the arrogance from hundreds of miles away. Nothing that happens outside the city matters, they say at their cocktail parties, blissfully unaware of where their food is grown. Hey, remember when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans? Kind of weird that a big hurricane hundreds of miles across managed to snipe one specific city and avoid everything else. To watch the news or the multiple movies and TV shows about it, you'd barely hear about how the storm utterly steamrolled rural Mississippi, killing 238 people and doing an astounding $125 billion in damage. But who cares about those people, right? What's newsworthy about a bunch of toothless hillbillies crying over a flattened trailer? New Orleans is culturally important. It matters. To those ignored, suffering people, one candidate is a brick chucked through the window of the city elites. Are you listening now? It's not just perception either. The stats back up the fact that these are parallel universes. People living in the countryside are twice as likely to own a gun and will probably get married younger. People in the urban blue areas talk faster and walk faster. They are more likely to be drug abusers, but less likely to be alcoholics. The Blues are less likely to own land, and most importantly, they're less likely to be evangelical Christians. Now, in the small towns, this often gets expressed as, they don't share our values. And my progressive friends love to scoff at that. What, like illiteracy and homophobia? Nope. Everything. You see, the cities are always living in the future. I remember when our little town got its first Chinese restaurant, and 20 years later, its first fancy coffee shop. Now, all of this stuff had turned up in movies, set in L.A., of course, decades earlier. Well, the perception back then was that those city folks were all turning atheist, abandoning church for their bisexual sex parties, that we were told was literally a sign of the apocalypse. And not just due to the spiritual consequences, which were dire, but the devastation that would come to the culture. I couldn't imagine any rebuttal. In that place, at that time, the church was everything. Now, don't take my word for it. Listen to the experts. In smaller communities, churches are commonly among the only venues for large social gatherings. Churches may also act as the sole providers of counseling, aid to the poor, and social activities, even if those take the form of choir music and Christmas pageants in rural communities. Church was where you made friends, met partners, networked for jobs, got social support. The poor could get food and clothes there. Couples could get advice on their marriages. Addicts could try to get clean. But now, we're seeing a startling decline in Christianity among the general population. So according to Fox News, what's the result of those decadent, atheist, amoral snobs in their cities having turned up their noses at God? Chaos. The fabric has broken down, they say, just as predicted. And what rural Americans see on the news today is a sneak peek at their tomorrow. The savages are coming. Blacks riot. Muslims set bombs. Gays spread AIDS. Mexican cartels behead children. Atheists tear down Christmas trees. Meanwhile, those liberal Lena Denims in their $5,000 a month apartments sip wine and say, but those white Christians are the real problem. Madness! Basic, obvious truths that have gone unquestioned for thousands of years now get laughed and shouted down. The fact that hard work is better than dependence on government, that children do better with both parents in the picture, that peace is better than rioting, that a strict moral code is better than blithe hedonism, that humans tend to value things they've earned more than they get for free, that not getting exploded by a bomb is better than getting exploded by a bomb. The foundation upon which America was undeniably built, family, faith, and hard work, had been deemed unfashionable and small-minded. Now, don't message me saying all those things I listed are wrong. I know they're wrong. I know the good old days of the past were built on slavery and segregation. I know that entire categories of humanity experienced religion only as a boot on their neck. I know that those traditional families involved millions of women trapped in kitchens and bad marriages. I know gays lived in fear and abortions were back alley affairs. I know the changes were for the best. But try telling that to anybody that lives in the country. They're getting less than the short end of the stick. Step outside of the city and the suicide rate among young people doubles. The recession pounded rural communities, but all the recovery went to the cities. The rate of new businesses opening in rural areas has utterly collapsed. See, rural jobs are based around one big local business, a factory, a coal mine, etc. When it dies, the town dies. Where I grew up, it was an oil refinery closing that did us in. Cities can make up for the loss of manufacturing jobs with service jobs. Small towns can't. That model doesn't work below certain population densities. Now, if you don't live in one of these small towns, you can't understand the hopelessness. The vast majority of possible careers involve moving to the city. And around every city is now a 100-foot wall called cost of living. Let's say you're a smart kid making $8 an hour at Walgreens and aspire to greater things. Fine. Get ready to move yourself and your new baby into a 700-square-foot apartment for $1,200 a month, and then pay double what you're paying now for utilities, groceries, and babysitters. They take it hard. These are people who come from a long line of folks who took pride in looking after themselves. Where I'm from, you weren't a real man unless you could repair a car, patch a roof, hunt your own meat, and defend your home against an intruder. It was a source of shame to be dependent on anyone, especially the government. You mowed your own lawn and fixed your own pipes when they leaked. You hauled your own firewood in your own pickup truck. The rural folk say their way of life is dying. And you smirk and say that they really mean is that blacks and gays are finally getting equal rights, and they hate it. But I'm telling you, they say their way of life is dying because their way of life is dying. It's not their imagination. No movie about the future portrays it as being full of traditional farmers, hunters, and coal miners. Well, except for the Hunger Games, and that was depicted as an apocalypse. So yes, they vote for the guy promising to put things back the way they were. The guy who would be a wake-up call to the Blue Islands. They want to vote for the brick through the window.
I prepare my sermon titles months in advance, and when I originally planned to do the sermon that was called Fake Fights Keep Us Busy, it was because it was right after General Assembly. How many of you went to General Assembly this year? A few. Not enough. More of you should go to General Assembly. And it was after the Reverend Nancy MacDonald Ladd had given an amazing Sunday worship, and part of her thesis was that she had named our great failing as a religious people, that we too often avoid the real work, the work like being active in the Black Lives Matter movement or creating the life-saving coalitions of justice that transform poverty or break the back of our Jim Crow school-to-prison pipeline, because we spend our time nitpicking about things like what we're going to keep in the church refrigerator, or what color we might be willing to paint the church bathroom. It's an important conversation to think about that, right? These fake fights. Over the years, I know that I have said many times and in many ways that churches are never built to make people happy and comfortable. They're not built to satisfy members' needs in the way that a retail outlet has to. Churches are built to save souls and transform lives. This one is no different. Now, if you are here because of the ministers or the amazing music, or because you expect to be catered to or pleased by everything that happens within these walls, then I'm afraid that not only are you bound for disappointment, you have mistaken our purpose. Church is not here to serve you. We are here to save what must be saved and to create a better world. That is hard work. It means that we're very likely to be uncomfortable and disappointed at regular intervals, but we will also be bolder, we will be more loving, and we will be transformational people if we hold one another's hands and we go together into the storm. So that's what I intended to preach, to take time with and on, but as Spirit would have it, I'm preaching not long after Yom Kippur in the days of one of the worst election seasons we have ever seen in this country. I'm preaching it when in less than 24 hours, a woman named Kelly Oxford received over 10 million tweets from women describing the first time they were sexually assaulted. A season where the First Lady of our country almost wept as she described her pain at what she had personally felt over the past weeks, at what it feels like to have worked so hard uplifting girls around the world only to see the horrors we're willing to tolerate in our public discourse here in the United States. It comes on the heels of people gleefully and angrily adopting the mantle of deplorables, as slightly more than half of us disdainfully reject slightly less than the half of the rest of us. My friends, these are very dark and dangerous days. I don't need to tell you that. Here's what I feel like I do need to tell you. It's our job to fix this. And I'm not kidding. Because if not us, then who? I mean, do we imagine that the magic of the presidency will fix the problems that we have with each other as a country? If you imagine that, I just want to point out to you the state of the nation after one of the most honorable men ever to serve in that office, the current office holder, is ending his term. Presidents, far from being our salvation, serve now to radicalize us away from each other. Now, I'm one of those UUs who listens pretty much nonstop, especially right now, to political podcasts and shows. And I heard an analyst say something really important recently. The analyst said, our elections are not about issues. They are about identity. And identity is the hardest thing to change or to work around. So my point this morning isn't to dwell on presidential politics. They are just the context in which we find ourselves, and the current climate created by that is what I meant when I subtitled it, How to Survive a National Nightmare. Keep in mind, of course, that not all things are equal in this race, but the discourse has grown dangerous and toxic, and I mean it unironically when I say, this is ours to fix. This is the time for each of us to just set aside any of those fake fights that we may have in this community or out there, because we have real work to do. Our Unitarian Universalist faith is built on some particular foundations, that each of us are free agents, that we choose to be together for hope and inspiration and insight, and because we are stronger together. We declare that rather than separating us and setting us at odds against one another, our differences, they enrich us. They enhance our lives. They transform us both individually and as communities of faith. And this last part, which is so essential, is, I'm afraid, more aspirational than factual in most places. So now is the time to test ourselves on our ability to live out in practice what we pride ourselves on in theology. We need to be the ones who are ready to reach out, to understand, to empathize, to get past the increasingly rigid boundaries of political identity and become human again together with people of all kinds, including people who have very different beliefs than us. My friends, we really must rise to this challenge. Now, sociologists and psychologists will tell you that the deck has never been stacked higher against us. If you sometimes feel that you live in a different world from some of the folks you know, you're not mistaken. More so than any other time in our history, people across especially political divides not only hold different governing principles, which we've always done, we actually cleave to different facts. Do you see these big quotation marks here? Facts. I mean, yes, there's still something that we can all call reality. Things can still be observed and measured, and details can be accurately recorded. However, and if you identify more with the political left than the political right, don't get too cocky, because although it is generally true that those who identify as politically progressive or liberal do adhere more to what is observably and measurably factual, we all have mistaken, overinterpreted, simplified, and sometimes just flat-out wrong data. We live in a time when people cannot even agree on what is factual and what is not. And alas, we've created this cultural monstrous space where what I feel is true holds as much weight or even more than what I can know based on measurable outcomes. But I'm going to ask a real question of you now. And I don't want you to raise your hand. I don't want you to indicate externally, but think to yourself honestly. Over the past month, how many of you at one time or in one place or another have either said or thought about people with whom you disagreed that they are deplorable? Yeah, me too. I mean, it's easier, isn't it, right? You know, to just lump people together, to assume we understand them, to believe they're what? That they're just racist, misogynist, unredeemable human wastes of space. To dismiss them, to feel righteous about our own positions and ideas, because clearly we are on the right side of history. And that's a phrase that we love, right? The right side of history. It's real. It does motivate us, and in fact, it should. But here's the thing. No matter how right our causes may be, the people with whom we disagree are full human beings. They have real fears. They have real hopes. They love fiercely. They are frequently kind. They serve the world in so many ways. They too feed the poor, even if they themselves are poor. If we love facts, then the fact is that people who have the least often share the most. That is a true thing. People with whom we don't relate, they have values. They want a better world. We tend to get stuck on the details, of course, but here's the thing. Our dreams are the doorway. It is through understanding what we love and what we hope for ourselves and our children that our path together lies. So that reading that Lenny shared earlier so incredibly well, I mean, I hope it offered some insight. I know in Wyoming, we understand well enough what it's like when a community fails, when suicide rates and drug and alcohol abuse skyrockets, what it's like to feel hopeless because there's no work that can support you, and yet you can't leave. Moving or finding housing in a more urban setting is literally out of reach. It's the rock, the hard place. What do people dream of when they're frightened and demoralized, when what they and their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents have all valued, when it's crumbling, when the mind closes and your children have so much less than you did? How do most people express anxiety and fear? Anger. Anger is the most common way we express fear. When we're not angry, we're depressed. When we're angry and fearful, the easiest things in the world to do are two. One, anoint a savior. The other, demonize some other. Can we understand this? I mean, can we empathize? Can we see people as they really are, hurt, afraid, needing very real security that seems like maybe it's gone forever? The scaffolding of our religious tradition is our faith that we need not think alike to love alike. Our differences don't have to divide us. Now is the time to make that more than just pretty words. Now is the time when every one of us, every single person in this room, needs to become a missionary of a new world, when we have to reach out and invite people into a different conversation, when we have to understand that people cling to their identities most when they feel that those identities are threatened. And we don't have to change anybody's identity. That's not the job of a faith-filled people. That's not our job. What the world needs us to do is just to get beyond people's anger and wounded pride, to connect with them as people who love, people who care about things. So, can we change the subject? Can we, instead of railing against scary others, and of course, you know, we do it as much as anyone else, can we wonder about what might help them most? Think for a moment about that devastated small town. The main industry there is gone forever. So what do they need, right? Well, we need good schools that include excellent trade education alongside college prep work, because not everybody needs to go to college, but everyone needs meaningful work that can support them with a living wage and health care and retirement, enough to support a family. Even small communities need plumbers and welders and electricians, people who can put in drywall, people who can fix cars and roads and bridges and save people's lives and put out fires. We need good teachers. We need caregivers. We can invest in small farms. We can improve internet connectivity and speed so that more people can have tech jobs that aren't place-based. You know, there's nothing that has to be hopeless about a small community whose main industry has departed. We just have to care and make sure that our attention is as focused there as it is on an urban setting with a higher population density. It's our time to cape up. It's our time to get out and change the conversation. We're not going to dismiss the people who are angry as deplorable. Yes, some do deplorable things. We all do. And we never do so many as when we are frightened, when we see the lives we have lived and loved disappearing, when our communities are desperate, they're racked by addiction and suicide, or when the privileges that we have enjoyed are under threat. Now, these are all hard things for anyone to deal with, and that does include the loss of privilege. For example, right now, men are feeling at sea a lot of times as women move forward to take their rightful place as equals. And white people, especially those who live in impoverished or disadvantaged communities, are confused and angry as the intersections of class and race just clash painfully. Now, I know Gretchen used this metaphor last week, this birthing metaphor, and not all of us are women and not all of us are mothers, or some of you maybe not women, it's true. But I still think it's worth thinking about that laboring metaphor, right? We're trying to move into a future that we don't quite see yet. We want equality, we want different things that are sustainable. And we're still finding our footing between something like a libertarian moral free-for-all and a human decency that doesn't oppress. And these are hard changes, and we're moving through them very quickly. So it isn't unlike the stages of labor, which are painful and often involve screaming invective at our beloveds. This is all your fault. You did this to me. Curse you. But love is what got us here, and love can get us through it if we see beyond the acting out of pain and fear into that real human need that undergirds it. You can understand it if someone says, "I've lost everything and I'm angry." What they are also saying is, "I need help, but I don't want you to do it for me. Instead, I need you to listen, to talk to me about the tools that I need so that I and my neighbors can recreate our community." We can do this. This is what we were meant for. If we are the people we claim to be, then we can set aside those fake fights that distract us and keep us petty and small and keep us comfortably not doing the real work that must be done. We can talk to people, not about politics, but about what frightens them. And please remember, don't be put off by some of those first answers, which may default to old scripts like, I want a city where there are no immigrants. No, no. What do they feel a safe community feels like? What are their stories of times when they were surprised by a stranger's goodness? What helps them feel loved and encouraged in their lives? What would help the community the most? My friends, we were made for these days. So let us not criticize one another over small failings, but inspire each other to have the transformational conversations and to take actions that increase love, increase hope, and make a better world. As the great song goes, we are the ones we've been waiting for. And I want to close that while I am advocating that we go high when they go low, it doesn't mean that I don't know that some of us are also hurting deeply and are also angry. So I want to close with these words by Stephen Schick, and this is called Useful Anger. And it starts with a small quote from Marge Piercy. A good anger swallowed clots the blood to slime. But what is to be done with it, this anger that dare not be swallowed? Should it be diluted with denial, cooled with indifference? Should it be sweetened with good intentions or softened with lies? Should it be spewed out over red-hot searing tongues, scorching the guilty and innocent alike? What's to be done with it, this anger that dare not be swallowed? Don't dilute it, deny it, or cool it. Don't sweeten it or soften it. But pause for a moment. Could you hold it before your eyes? Examine it with your heart and mind? Could you hold it to touch your belly, that place where your soul resides? Could you let it enter there, knowing it is the part of you that needs to be treated kindly, that needs to be listened to, that needs to be honored? For it has the power to save you, to save us all. Amen. These closing words are by the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai, who said, from the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, like a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. Go in peace, return in joy.